Welcome back to Generals and Napoleon. We have a very special guest today. We have a very good friend of mine from Louisiana State University here at Shreveport campus, Alexander Mikaberidze. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, you did it well. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
I like the pronunciation.
I take great pride in my pronunciation. As someone who studies French towns and cities and last names, you have to, right?
Yeah, indeed.
Alexander, he's a professor, like I said, at LSU. He also has a few books out. I highly recommend them. You can find them on Amazon. And he also hosts a podcast, which I love, Napoleonic Quarterly. And could you give us like a brief sketch of what that podcast is about?
Yeah, it's actually three of us, Alex Stevenson, my good old friend, Charles Esdale, and me. And I think the uniqueness of this podcast is that we are looking at the entirety of the revolutionary era from 1792 to 1815, but in 3 month chunks. And we kind of look in depth what happened in each 3 months, why it is important, kind of wider context. And I think that is something quite unusual and unique. And we have awesome guest speakers who kind of work in these particular areas. So each episode has a rotating three or more guest speakers. And so far it's doing quite well. And of course, we have a long road to go. We have actually, Alex, Charles, and I, we just recorded one on the beginning of 1798. So we still have 17 long years to go.
Right. Well, let's hop right into it. Let's start off with the sly old fox from the north, General Kutuzov.
Yeah, this is the guy that I spent last 3 years kind of chatting and in company of since I just published in September his biography. Mm-hmm. And it's a good example of these existing historiographical problem when it comes to Napoleonic Wars. Here we see one of the most iconic general of the era, a field marshal, a distinguished general. And yet the last biography of his was published decades ago, and it was quite awful.
As a literary critic, it was quite awful.
Yeah. And, I mean, the author who's written extensively on this period, but none of his works are really kind of in-depth and serious work. The author went to kind of made shortcuts and in some cases invented facts or misinterpreted facts. So there was a lot that needs to be kind of corrected and needed to be corrected and improved on. So Kutuzov is an interesting guy for a number of reasons. Needless to say, I mean, I spent the biography that I wrote of his is some 900 pages. So there was a lot to write about him.
Yeah.
He's born into a noble family, an eminent noble family. He's among the kind of wealthier aristocrats in Russia. And he received very good military education. He went to some of the best military schools in Russia, kind of the cutting edge of the phenomenon that my good friend Christy P. Kekero described as the military enlightenment, right? Mm-hmm. I think many of our listeners are familiar with enlightenment, but now in the last few years, the focus is on kind of the impact of the enlightenment on the war, and that phenomenon is the military enlightenment. And Kutuzov is in many respects the person who benefited from it, but also contributed to it. So he studied under great teachers at the joint artillery and engineer school. In Russia, and then after graduating at the top of his class, effectively he starts his career that will ultimately go on for some 54 years.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point you brought up. You know, people are like, "Oh, Napoleon was such an enlightened guy. He was beating like all these old school generals who didn't know what they were doing." And I think that's a big fallacy. I mean, these generals, whether they're Austrian or Prussian or Russian, they're very talented individuals, correct?
Absolutely. And I think these are, as we'll, I mean, I hope we'll have an opportunity to talk today about that, infamous for the Russians campaign at Austerlitz, mm-hmm. where if the Tsar had listened to men like Kutuzov, the history of Europe, and I would say history of the world would have been absolutely different, since I have no doubt whatsoever, having finished this book, that Kutuzov would have turned that campaign to the victory of allies.
Agreed. Yeah, and we will get to that. We will get to that.
It's a foundational campaign, right, for Napoleon.
Yep.
There are multiple factors why experienced men like Kutuzov, or, you know, Prussian generals or Austrian generals like Alvinzi or Archduke Karl, why they go on and get defeated by Napoleon. And it's not necessarily because they were inept or incompetent, but rather because they were oftentimes caught in circumstances that they simply couldn't control, that was beyond right. their level of control.
Right. And, you know, Napoleon wasn't the only brilliant tactician at this time. There was a guy named Suvorov, correct, in Russia?
Absolutely. You know, Suvorov was the most brilliant commander of that Russia produced in this early modern period.
Right.
Absolutely amazing.
And he didn't look the part. He was like this little tiny little farmer guy.
That's right. Oh, very unusual, kind of quirky, eccentric. But there, behind that eccentricity, you can see the sharpness of his mind, his keen understanding of human nature. You read his orders to the army, and he speaks the language that the soldiers do. But it's deliberately so, because he's one of the first commanders to understand that success in war and battle is dependent on whether not just your officer, but your soldiers, right? Those rank and file
right.
understand what you expect from them. And so he tried to talk to them in the language that they did understand. And, you know, Napoleon does the same thing with his bulletins, right? Later mm-hmm. on, those are designed to inform and kind of shape the minds of his soldiers to kind of inspire them, but also to tell them what are their expectations. And Suvorov has done that before Napoleon did. Yep.
So absolutely. And so Kutuzov, he learns basically how to draft simple, concise orders and how to care for his men from Suvorov, correct?
That is one of the issues I've kind of taken up in my book. So if we look at this existing traditional historiography, there is a long-standing myth, that's what I call it, a myth of Kutuzov being the disciple of Suvorov, kind of teaching him the ABCs of military service and so on. Mm. And there is a kernel of truth in it, but mostly it is untrue.
Okay.
And what I mean by this is that Kutuzov was lucky that he his first job, really, serious job, kind of field job, out of school, was as a company commander in the regiment that Suvorov commanded. Mm-hmm. But what is oftentimes forgotten to mention is that Suvorov only commanded that regiment for about 6 months, that mm-hmm. while Kutuzov was there. So he met the guy, he kind of got to know him, he did write a nice recommendation for Kutuzov, but there was no serious engagement. And certainly considering that Kutuzov in 1762-63 is 14 years old, I mean,
yeah,
I don't know what you were doing at 14, clearly not commanding a company, but nonetheless, there is,
yeah.
I doubt that there was a much much learning involved.
Yeah,
it is later on, in late 1770s and kind of early 1780s, that their path cross again. Mm-hmm. But even then, Suvorov is commanding an army that is separate from the one that Kutuzov is serving. And the only occasion where you have kind of hands-on Suvorov-Kutuzov relationship is during the Russo-Turkish War in 1790, when Suvorov was sent to lead the assault on that famous Ottoman fortress of Izmail, and Kutuzov commanded one of the assault columns. And he distinguished himself, and Suvorov famously said that Kutuzov was on my left flank, but he was my right hand. Ah. And I think that kind of... that nugget, that kind of little bits of,
right, you
know, act of their relationship was later on blown up into this full blown kind of relationship between the master and disciple. But I'm not a believer in it. I think as a person, as a character, Kutuzov was absolutely different from Suvorov, and in his approach to war, in his approach to planning battles, planning operations, he is far more methodical, far more kind of defensive-minded than Suvorov. We can kind of look and compare their campaigns, and to me, they are day and night.
Now, if we may fast forward a little bit from there, but that's a great point on the Suvorov-Kutuzov relationship. There's every picture you see of Kutuzov, he looks like this corpulent, lazy, overweight guy.
Yes.
And his eye, it looks misfigured, but that's for a reason, correct?
Yes. So let me maybe state from the onset that the traditional portrayal of him with an eye patch is not true. In fact, it is an invention of Soviet cinema. Kutuzov never wore an eye patch, but he did suffer what I describe as a 2.5 grievous head injuries. He was shot twice in the head, plus at Austerlitz, a splinter struck him in the cheek. Now, those two head injuries were absolutely remarkable. Yeah. The first one takes place in, both of them take place in Crimea. The first one is in 1770s and the other one is in early 1780s. The first one is particularly interesting because it was a medical sensation.
So this should have been lethal, right? I mean, that should have been it.
Absolutely. I mean, to kind of describe to your listeners, this is taking place during Russo-Ottoman War. Especially for the American listeners, who will be struck maybe by the parallel to the 1815 Battle of New Orleans. The peace treaty was already signed when the battle was fought. And in this case, Treaty of Kutch-Kainardji was also already signed, but the news of it has not reached the the Crimean countryside. And the battle took place at a small village. And Kutuzov was leading this group of grenadiers. And as they were charging towards the Ottoman position, they had to cross the trench. And as Kutuzov was climbing out of the trench, he kind of got on the boulder so that people, you know, his soldiers could see him. And he tried to inspire them to move forward. And as he turned kind of to look at his soldiers, the Ottoman bullet struck him in the left temple, went through his cranium, and exited on the right temple. So it actually penetrated his entire skull.
Wow.
Now, Ukrainian archaeologists have done a really interesting study on the battlefield, and they recovered a lot of spent bullets from that area. And the average size of the projectile that they found is about 18 millimeters, so about, you know, more than half an inch. So imagine that thing striking your temple and passing somehow in your right prefrontal area without damaging the brain. And remember, this is the right. This is the time before antiseptics, before any kind of germ theory.
Modern surgery, yeah.
Yeah. So Kutuzov was lucky that there was a very talented French surgeon in the Russian army, who was able to treat him well enough that he didn't get any complications. He didn't get any inflammation. The bullet, he was also lucky that the bullet passed through without damaging his brain,
right,
but it did damage the muscles of his eye. And therefore, when we look at the Kutuzov's portrait, he's always shown with that left eye kind of to the front, and the right eye is usually the back, not showing that it was kind of skewed out.
Right.
Although he could still see from both eyes, so
yeah.
He had later on developed the problem with the light sensitivity, but otherwise it's a remarkable, really, survival. And that was the first case.
Yeah.
The second time, he was in Crimea again at the great siege of Ochakov, and one of the officers, there was an Ottoman sortie, an Ottoman kind of attack from the fortress, and the officer called Kutuzov to look out from the embrasure to look at where the Turks were attacking. And as luck would have it, Kutuzov looks out, and just then the Ottoman bullet strikes him in the left cheek, goes kind of through his mouth and exits on the other side. Kind of crisscross, you know, injuries, right?
Yeah.
And once again, he survived. His speech was unaffected. He got no inflammation. In fact, 6 months later, he was healthy enough to get back into saddle.
Did he travel to Western Europe for treatment on his eye and his injuries?
Yes. So because the first injury was, I would say, almost unprecedented in terms of getting shot and surviving it. Empress Catherine gave him a furlough and actually effectively paid for all his medical expenses, which allowed Kutuzov to travel to Berlin, to Vienna and Leiden. Leiden actually had a really strong medical school at the time. And so he visited these places kind of seeking treatment, but also meeting local kind of prominent people. There are stories of him interacting with Frederick the Great and meeting some of the great Austrian field marshals in Vienna. But unfortunately, there is not enough kind of information surviving on who exactly he met and where and how.
Right.
So when I tried to kind of look it up, it was hard. I couldn't find any substantive information for it, but we do know that he traveled.
I see a lot of these stories and articles about who met Frederick the Great and who studied under Frederick the Great, and it's the evidence is flimsy at best.
Yeah, and even if he so I looked at Frederick's court journals, which usually recorded who came and who went, and there's no mention of Kutuzov. And certainly there's no mention of him in kind of Frederick's correspondence. So it would have been a social meeting at right. one of the kind of dinners. So I would not attach much kind of attention to it because you know, it would have been a passing kind of encounter.
Well, let's jump ahead to our favorite topic, to Austerlitz in 1805, if you don't mind.
No, not at all. Yeah, especially this is one of those moments when, I have a chapter in the biography that's called Eclipse of Austerlitz, and that's a play on the words for Napoleon's son of Austerlitz.
No, I think it was his best battle by far. You know, he feigned weakness. He'd been, you know, he had the Ulm campaign. He was stretched to the limit of his supply chain, Napoleon was.
There is a longstanding myth, which has unfortunately been spread around for quite some time, that the failure of this joint operation was due to the difference in calendar. And let me assure you
I've read that. Yeah.
Not true. Yeah. If we look at the original sources, documents, memorandums that both sides negotiated, they knew perfectly well about the difference of calendars. They dated Russian documents oftentimes dated by in both calendars, and the decisive documents that they signed with the Austrians were all in this new style Gregorian calendar. So there is no problem with the calendar as such. Yeah. The problem was, in many respects, the Austrian decision to launch the campaign in order to force Bavaria out of that perceived neutrality before the Russians even made it halfway to the Bavarian border. And that was a huge mistake because that meant that it gave Napoleon a head start. So about 10 days of head start over Kutuzov. So which meant that by late October, when Kutuzov is approaching the Bavarian borders, it's too late. Austrian army is already at Ulm. It's encircled. And about to be destroyed. That's one problem. Second, and it's a problem of coalition warfare. A warfare where you have multiple partners, oftentimes partners that are not particularly trusting each other. And here what we see is that Austrians oftentimes didn't share the full picture with Kutuzov as he was moving to the Bavarian border. So by the time he reaches the border, he is, for example, unaware of the problems the Austrian army is facing. He only rediscovers the disaster that befell the Austrian army when he encountered the Austrian commander Mack at Braunau, that famous encounter that Tolstoy describes in War and Peace.
Yeah.
But Kutuzov then successfully evades Napoleon's pursuit, and he's able to save the Russian army and bring it to the small town of Olmutz. And this is where the story gets really interesting, because at Olmutz, the remnants of Austrian army joined Russians. The Russian reinforcements also arrive. And of course, the main Austrian army was not in Germany. It actually was in northern Italy, and Archduke Charles was leading it back. So it was at the time on the plains of Hungary. So when Alexander, Russian emperor, and Francis, Austrian emperor, came to Olmutz, and they had the Council of War, Kutuzov came out with a very sensible solution to the problems by pointing out that they simply need to wait it out.
Yeah.
Right? And I think he argued that if we wait two or three weeks, Allied forces will be twice the size of Napoleon's army. Napoleon is about 600 miles from the French borders.
Right.
His line of supplies, his lines of communication is all exposed. It's like that, Napoleon's army is like an arrow, right? It has penetrated deep into the Austrian domain, but the shaft is too slim. It can be snapped. The problem was, and you already mentioned this, that this is the first time Russian Tsar is in charge of the army in the campaign. Mm-hmm. In fact, it is the first time Russian emperor is leading an army since the days of Peter the Great. So it's been a while. So there's a lot of kind of stake in terms of prestige and reputation and perception.
Why is he doing that? Just to prove that he's just as powerful as Napoleon? Or what's he doing at the front?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is that. Part of it is the fact that Alexander is surrounded by a young yes men, right? Mm-hmm. The sycophants who, like Dolgorukov, like others, were kind of telling him that he's awesome, that he can do it, that we can win this, that Napoleon is weak. I mean, Kutuzov repeatedly objected to this.
Yeah, I wonder, if the sycophants in the room were like, oh, don't listen to that old fat man sleeping in the corner, listen to us, you know?
Oh, yeah. In fact, at one of the meetings with the Tsar, when Kutuzov objected, Dolgorukov kind of snickered at him, condescendingly.
Right.
And Kutuzov turned and kind of roared at him and said, what are you laughing at, young man? Do you think I'm a coward and I fear battling? And he kind of points out his injuries on the face.
Right.
He says, my wounds speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then he storms out. But that is a crucial meeting, because once Kutuzov leaves, Dolgorukov turns to Tsar, and the eyewitness describes the Tsar as kind of deep in his thought, because he's a smart man. He certainly understood what Kutuzov was saying was sensible.
Right.
And Dolgorukov kind of pushes the button. He knows that button that works with Tsar. And he says, if your majesty retreats, Napoleon will think of us as cowards.
Uh-huh.
And the eyewitness kind of describes the Alex as being kind of startled by this. And he looks at Dolgorukov and says, cowards? No, it is better for us to die. And that kind of sense, I think, misplaced sense of masculinity and honor and wanting to prove yourself means that the advice that Kutuzov offers is completely ignored. And Tsar orders the Allied armies to move forward. Even on the way there, Kutuzov tries repeatedly to warn them, and he's ignored. And of course, the last and most famous attempt is during that infamous Council of War, when the Austrian officer Weyrother is drawling and reading that incomprehensible disposition for the attack. Right? And Kutuzov is sitting in the armchair, and eyewitnesses describe him as kind of sleeping.
Yeah.
But the reality was, if we look close, is that he simply gave it up. He essentially says, F it, right?
Yeah.
I've done everything possible to avoid this battle. They're not listening to me. Yeah. I'm going to take a nap.
Well, this Weyrother, his strategy was such that Napoleon wanted him to do exactly as he did. It was almost, he was accused of being in the pay of Napoleon for his strategy. It was
absolutely. And then Russians, after the battle, Russians held grudges against the Austrians. And Dolgorukov, for example, later on wrote an article that was published in a newspaper directly accusing Austrians of treason, that they led, kind of intentionally, deliberately led the Russian army to destruction. But it was a bit too late, right?
Yeah. Let's just briefly summarize the battle. You know, they attack Davout on the right side. They leave the Pratzen Heights. And when they do, Soult and his men rush up and take the Pratzen Heights. And obviously debacle, you know, the Russians and Austrians lose. I think it's a large number of forts. It's almost 16,000 killed and wounded versus only, you know, 7,000 for the French.
Yeah, I guess you're not counting prisoners or the wounded.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the total number is much higher. Yeah.
But here you see
kind of a couple of things. One is that if we look at Weyrother's kind of battle plan, the basic idea is actually quite appropriate.
Turn the flank, drive them
into the mountains, destroy.
Yep.
But of course, what Weyrother doesn't know is that Napoleon expects him to do that. And I think this is where Napoleon's brilliance is. He's anticipating the enemy. But having said so, and in the book I kind of question it, whether we would have said the same, you know, whether that can be said, you know, that Austerlitz is a great Napoleon's victory. But to what extent it is a great victory if the enemy ignores the rational advice that would have prevented the battle in the first place?
Yep.
I mean, this is a scenario where your opponent is almost deliberately trying to sabotage its own victory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really fascinating. And you mentioned, the strategy on the Austrian-Russian side was sound, but they were up against this genius guy who knew what they were going to do.
Except if Kutuzov had a chance. See, this is the thing. If he had a chance to be in charge as his position as a commander-in-chief entitled him, this battle, first of all, would not have been fought, and the outcome of the war would have been profoundly different.
Agreed.
Even on the day of the battle, that morning, right, the morning of December 2nd, the sun rises, and Napoleon kind of looks over it or through the fog, right?
Yep.
Kutuzov stands on the other side, on those Pratzen Heights, and he effectively knows what's going to happen. This is the tragedy, I think, of this man, is that he knows what's going to happen because he waits and refuses to follow the disposition of sending the fourth column, Kolovrat's column, from Pratzen Heights down on this flanking maneuver.
Mm-hmm.
And he waits until Tsar shows up, right, with his posse. And there's a wonderful scene there where Alex comes and says, "What's going on? Why are the soldiers standing?
Mm-hmm.
Why are they not moving?" And Kutuzov says, "I'm waiting." And Alex kind of looks around and chuckles, and he says, "What are you waiting for? We are not on the parade grounds." And Kutuzov kind of snark-like responds, "That's precisely why I'm waiting, because we are not on the damn parade grounds. I know what's going to happen, right?"
Right, right.
And Alex overrules him and orders the troops to start moving from the Pratzen Heights down. And just at that moment, right, as the troops are starting moving, that famous counterattack begins.
Yeah.
So in some respects, I look at Kutuzov as this, on the day of Austria, as this tragic individual. He tried his best to avoid the battle. He can't. It's a personal tragedy because his beloved son-in-law is shot dead or mortally wounded, leading one of those counter charges to contain the French assault on Pratzen Heights.
Yeah.
So he has to carry his son-in-law's body back home. And of course, he presides over this disaster of massive proportions
that he will be held responsible for. Yeah, let's talk about the aftermath. Obviously, it's a rout. The French are, attacking Murat, sending the cavalry for pursuit. What is Alexander doing? What is Kutuzov doing?
Well, in the middle of the battle, they can't find Alex. There is this confusion, of course. The losses are very high on the Allied side, especially among the officers, who many of them are wounded or simply dispersed and missing in action. So the command control chain is disrupted, and Alex could not be found until one of his aide-de-camps finds him sitting under a tree and crying. I bet he was thinking I should have listened to Kutuzov.
Well, that night,
it's Kutuzov who rallies the troops. It's Kutuzov who leads them to safety.
Right.
And ultimately, it is Kutuzov who leads them all the way back home. Alex goes back to St. Petersburg. And in a relationship between the two men, which was already quite tense, and that's a separate subject that kind of can take us back to the murder of Emperor Paul, mm-hmm. in which Alexander, of course, was complicit. But those relations only get worse because of that Austerlitz fiasco, right?
And I think that's interesting. Like, you know, it wasn't Kutuzov's idea. It wasn't his fault. Yet somehow he gets the blame. Now, I understand the boss never gets the blame, but...
that's right.
Yeah.
But you know what? Kutuzov, almost the same night, the night of the battle already, he understands that this is going to be his legacy, right? He's going to be shouldered with this. So he already, that night, is trying to lay the grounds for his reputation to be
rehabilitated,
right?
Yeah.
And he meets with soldiers, and every time he meets the soldiers that night, the bonfires, he tries to explain what happened and explain that, hey, it's not my fault. I'm not going to say whose fault it is, but it's not my fault. But my favorite part is when 7 years later, and this is 1812, November, Napoleon is barely making his way out of Russia, right? His army is essentially destroyed. And on the outskirts of Smolensk, after the Battle of Krasny, the Russians capture dozens of flags, French flags, and they bring it to Kutuzov, and one of the flags, this kind of iconic, right, tricolor flag with golden embroidery showing the names of the battles that the French won, one of them flags Austerlitz. Mm. So Kutuzov looks at this flag and gives an impromptu speech, and then at the end of it, he says, remember, I'm not to be blamed for Austerlitz.
Well, let's go ahead and jump ahead to 1812, if you don't mind. Now, he's somewhat sidelined between 1805 and 1812, right?
He is, and that's, again, kind of the after effect of Austerlitz. Partly, I think Alex didn't want him kind of as a reminder of, hey, I told you so. Partly, it's because Kutuzov himself is burned out. Mm-hmm. And he goes to Kyiv in 1806. And he stays there for quite some time. So it is from Kyiv that he's following the events in Prussia, right? The implosion of Prussia in 1806.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Russo-French campaign, Second War in 1806, 1807 in Poland.
Yep.
And ultimately, he's recalled from this kind of semi-exile because Alexander needs somebody to lead the troops against the Turks. The war against the Turks began in 1806, and it has been too long, no progress, no major victories shown. And so he sends Kutuzov to what is today Romania, mm-hmm. to lead one of the Russian corps there. And he's quite good at this. By 1811, he will take charge of the entire army, the so-called Army of Moldavia, later on becomes Army of Danube. And with that army, he conducts a masterful campaign, which I devote three chapters in the book because I thought, I still think that Kutuzov as the commander really shines in 1810, 1811,
mm-hmm.
because it is his operational brilliance, it's his tactical brilliance. I look at him and I see all the elements and hallmarks of what we think of as Napoleonic campaigns all being manifested by him against the Turks.
Mm-hmm. But towards the end of that war, the Russo-Turkish War, 1806-1812, does he realize that his troops might be needed elsewhere?
Yes, and that's one kind of the urgency where Alexander already in 1811, of course, sees the war coming. And mm-hmm. we see Russian preparations for the war starting well before 1812. And for Kutuzov, the knockoff effect is that Alex is pushing him to crush the Turks as soon as possible. But it's, of course, easier said than done. And even though Kutuzov scores a brilliant victory at Russe in 1811, even then, Ottomans still refuse to negotiate with the Russians because they know that the war between Russia and France is impending, and they just want to wait it out. Mm-hmm. And in many respects, it's Kutuzov who, once again, very rationally advocates cutting losses, finding some compromise with the Turks, and ending the war so they can release 60,000 troops that were committed at this theater. Right. And ultimately, it's his vision that materializes, because Alex wanted to grab what is all of Moldavia today, what is all of Romania and parts of Bulgaria, and urged him to give up on this conquest and keep just a little bit that the Turks were willing to give because there was a much bigger threat to deal with. And ultimately, that's the vision that prevails in May of 1812, when Kutuzov signs the Treaty of Bucharest. Russia effectively gave up on 6 years' worth of conquests against the Turks and only retained a small piece of territory called Bessarabia. But, of course, the upshot was that the Southern Front was now secured and those tens of thousands of troops could be used against Napoleon.
Right. And if I may transition on the other front, the French have invaded in June, and Barclay de Tolle, who's the commander, is facing odds of 2-1, and he's retreating and bringing Napoleon deeper into the country. Now, poor de Tolle, people are calling him a coward, and he doesn't know what he's doing, and he should stand up to Napoleon. And then the Battle of Smolensk happens, and it's pretty much a terrible battle on both sides. But after that, I think Alexander's had enough of de Tolle, correct?
Even with that, before he knew about the battle fought at Smolensk on the 17th of August, right? So the battle just started, and of course, Alex, having no internet or cell phones, doesn't know it. Even before that, Alex is convening a meeting of the special committee that was tasked with selecting the new commander-in-chief. And of course, the reason for this is the perceived failure of Barclay de Tolle to stop the French invasion. Mm-hmm. So irrespective of the outcome of Smolensk, Barclay de Tolle would have been removed.
Interesting.
From the command.
Interesting. And the choices available, obviously, the Bagration, there's Bennigsen, but they go to the old war horse, right? They go to Kutuzov.
Yes. If you look at the kind of the proceedings, kind of the agenda or the minutes of that meeting, you see them looking at the top hierarchy of the generals. One, and hopefully we'll talk about Barclay de Tolle, but whom I have a great respect for.
Me too.
For him, 1812 is a tragic moment. And you see the tragedy of this man who, like Kutuzov in 1805, Barclay de Tolle understands what is the right strategy, but he also knows that it is highly unpopular strategy, and yet he perseveres, he carries that burden. And so when the special committee met, there were several things that they wanted to account for. One was that they wanted to appoint somebody who will carry the weight. Mm-hmm. Barclay de Tolle, if we look at his career, and which was quite successful up to 1812, but he's not that heroic figure. He was effectively a brigade and divisional commander who served very well in 1806, 1807, has a wonderful kind of performance in Finland in 1808, 1809. But he doesn't have that recognition, that name recognition. He hasn't won a war. Mm-hmm. He hasn't won a campaign as such, right? That's one thing. Second, they wanted somebody of senior enough rank who could instill obedience.
Right.
Because one of the challenges Barclay de Tolly had was the fact that when it came to military rank, he was junior to Bagration.
You know,
and Bagration therefore refused to follow his advice.
That's
his
a great order. Point. That's a really great point. Yeah. I brought that up in a
and
previous
so,
episode. Previous episode yeah. that, you know, people always harp that Napoleon's marshals didn't get along with each other. There was competition, but there was competition in every army, even the Russian army. You know, with the
oh
general.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. imagine the egos, right? All of yeah. these are egos, huge egos, right? All of them won the glory and distinction and
yep.
awards and money.
Yep.
So, and especially in a war like this, which is perceived to be a patriotic war, it's a
right.
it's about, you know, the black and white and a Manichaean vision of us, the good guys, against them, the bad guys who are
yep.
godless, heathen, right? The revolutionaries, right?
Yep.
Absolutely. And so when they looked at the kind of who is available, Kutuzov was the only real candidate because
yep.
everyone else was either too old or not of high enough stature.
Let's jump to, if we may, to Borodino and the stand. You know, obviously Smolensk was a somewhat of a victory for Napoleon, and he decides to carry on the war to Moscow. And at Borodino, the Russians basically draw a line in the sand, and, you know, Kutuzov's in charge of that defensive battle. What did you think about his strategy there, and do you think it was a good idea to fight that battle?
This is another kind of vague moment, kind of complex moment, because looking at Kutuzov's letters, and I went through dozens and dozens of them,
mm-hmm.
I got the feeling, and you know, that's my contention that I'm sure people might disagree with. I got this idea that Borodino was conceived by him not necessarily as a battle that he would have won. In fact, on more than one occasion, he admits that he will not win this battle.
Mm-hmm.
But rather, he conceived this battle as accomplishing two things. One, it's a political battle. It's a battle for the hearts and minds of the Russian people. That here we make a stand. As you said, we draw the line and we make a stand when we show that we can fight. Because
mm-hmm.
until then, it's kind of perception is, hey, we keep retreating, giving up these cities, these villages. When are we going to fight? And so Borodino kind of accomplishes that PR, political,
right.
heart and minds part.
Right.
The second part is that if we look at the kind of tactical disposition, Kutuzov clearly does not envision this battle as being offensive for the Russian army. It's a defensive-minded battle. It is a battle that is that sees the Russian army dig in on those fortifications, Bagration's flèches on the left flank, the Great Battery in the middle, the Maslovo 10 fortifications on the right flank. It's a heavily fortified position.
Right.
And Kutuzov says in one of his letters that the goal was to let the French break their teeth on this nut, right? So essentially they will try to break us, but they will break their teeth at us.
And I'm glad you pointed it out like that. The Battle of Shevardino, where they had the one redoubt way out in front of the other ones, was almost like
that was actually not Kutuzov's idea. In fact, that is Kutuzov actually chose out the officer who was responsible for it, because the mm-hmm. when the army arrived on the September 4-5, it was deployed, if kind of for the readers to draw an imaginary kind of map. The Russian army was deployed along the Kolocha River, but that made its left flank completely exposed
mm-hmm.
to the French flanking strike. And that was the deployment that one of Kutuzov's officers, a guy by the name of Toll, Colonel Toll, was responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
And Kutuzov immediately recognized it, and that is why on September 5, he starts moving the army back towards the Semyonovska village. But as he's moving back, the French army arrives, and therefore Shevardino has to be defended as the as a way of preventing the French from arriving too soon. So it's a kind of battle in motion.
Yeah.
Which results in unnecessary losses, but you know, sometimes things like this happen in war, right?
Yeah, it almost reminds me of like a wave break, you know, like a bunch of rocks out in front to break the wave, and then we'll attack the rest.
Yeah, the redoubt, the Chouard Dinant, is the redoubt is a too of a glorious name for it. Mm-hmm. It's not nowhere near finished. It could not have contained or stopped the French army as such, but the idea was to simply delay it. Mm-hmm. And to that, it served its purpose. So the French army indeed kind of got delayed on September 5. The rest of the army, the Russian army, was able to retreat, take up position at Semyonovskaya, and then on the 7th of September, they will fight a decisive battle.
Yeah, and then, if I may, I think the battle, once it started, Kutuzov was plugging holes in the dam where he could, and he was redeploying as best he could. You know, he lost Bagration in the battle, and, you know, on the French side, massive losses. Davout was wounded, Ney was wounded. It was an epic battle, but the amazing thing, you know, whatever you want to call it, a pyrrhic victory for Napoleon, is that, if I'm not mistaken, Kutuzov reported it to Alexander as a victory.
Yes, and kind of to mention something, so Kutuzov is prudent enough to realize that in the battle, the type of battle he wants to wage, and that is, again, the battle of attrition, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't need to be a hands-on manager of everything. Mm-hmm. That is why if you read his order to the army on the day of the battle, he specifically says that he delegates the authority to his two subordinates, and that is Barclay de Tolly and Bagration, mm-hmm. both of them accomplished, veteran, experienced, capable men,
yep.
and he lets them fight this battle locally, right? So essentially, Barclay, you deal this with the right and center, Bagration, you deal with the left. And that is why Kutuzov is largely absent from the battle. He famously sits and eats fried chicken on top of the hill, right? But right. And it sometimes creates this vision of him him just being careless or not involved. But no, he paid close attention to the battle, but understanding that his role is in many respects is not needed because he has these two brilliant guys.
Mm-hmm.
Who, in many respects, acquitted the task that he gave them. Certainly Barclay de Tolly did.
You know, that's a great point, too. And Napoleon sometimes, you know, did that as well. You know, he gave an overall strategy to the battle, but he left the actual handling of it to his marshals.
Yeah, no, I think that's at least that's my conception of Borodino, and why... Kutuzov, by all eyewitness accounts, why he had this kind of hands-off approach.
Yeah.
If I had the likes of Bagration, Barclay de Tolly, Dokhturov, Raevsky, right, Bogovut, and others, and under my command, I would have given them kind of the basic instructions and then trusted them to take care of the rest. Platov, the guy that you mentioned, that one is a bit problematic. partly because he was drunk on the day of the battle. I mean, really, really drunk.
Yeah, he was unique, that one.
He was, yeah, let's say, yeah, let's keep it at that.
Yeah, that's a nice word. Yeah, unique. But to fast forward in the story, so the battle's won, Napoleon moves his army into Moscow and occupies the city. Where does Kutuzov take the army?
Well, Kutuzov, after abandoning Moscow, Kutuzov does a wonderful maneuver. Mm-hmm. It's called Tarutino maneuver, which Napoleon himself later on kind of talks about, grudgingly admits that was a great conception. Mm-hmm. And what that maneuver allows him is to mislead the French, and kind of Russian army pretends that it is retreating southeast, when in reality it actually makes a U-turn and marches to southwest. Mm. And it positions Russian army within the striking distance from the French lines of communication, but also safe enough from Moscow where it can rebuild itself.
Mm-hmm.
And through 35 days that Napoleon spends in Moscow, Kutuzov is building that army at the fortified camp at Tarutino.
Right.
So the Russian army doubled in size almost. It got tens of thousands of light cavalry of Cossacks. It received infantry. It rebuilt its artillery train. It got resupplied. All the while, of course, French army is living amidst the burned-out ruins of the former Russian capital.
Correct.
Another important element is that Kutuzov here in October is launching what we now call asymmetrical warfare. It is his concept that he refers to as the Little War, or Малая война, where he is willing to conduct hit-and-run operations on the exposed, vulnerable elements of the French military. So this will be the supply trains. This will be isolated detachments. And so for that purpose, he establishes more than two dozen flying detachments that effectively surround Moscow and prevent the French army, for example, from foraging too far afield. So that's the second very important element in this, in Kutuzov's strategy. And the third is that he very actively encouraged peasant arming and kind of or leading this what we will call the People's War, right? Where he would instruct his commanders to give the peasants weapons and let them form resistance units that will target these isolated French units. And so by kind of harnessing this conventional, this asymmetrical, and this popular element of the war, he wanted to create conditions where Napoleon's position will be untenable in Russia, and he will be forced to leave.
Right, and I think that's where we touch on Murat, who's friendly with these Cossacks. He's thinks he's befriending them, and then the surprise attack, I think led by Bennigsen at the Battle of Winkovo. I think that's what spurs Napoleon to finally give up Moscow and start the retreat back to France.
Yes, and once again, this is not the battle that Kutuzov wanted to fight. In fact, it is fought, I would say, in contravention to his wishes. Kutuzov, by late October, by mid-October, Kutuzov already was seeing kind of the fruits of his asymmetrical approach. Right. But of course, this approach is not sexy.
It doesn't result in great battles. Yeah.
There is no, won triumphs, no promotions, no awards. And so Bennigsen and many of the Russian officers got really anxious. They got anxious that, hey, we're just sitting here in this camp doing nothing and waiting. Waiting for what? Right. And so Bennigsen argued, and many other officers kind of supported him, that we need to take a more proactive approach. We need to strike back. We know that Murat's advance guard is isolated, is exposed and vulnerable. Why don't we attack? And Kutuzov's argument was that it will be like provoking a lion, right? To come out and strike at you. Why would you do that when the lion is slowly dying in his cave, right? and so he didn't want to fight this battle, but he's facing essentially a revolt, an officer's revolt led by Bennigsen, who forced him to give green light to an attack, which results in this battle of Tarutino, or Vinko, as the French call it. And of course, it is mismanaged, and that's where I think both Kutuzov and Bennigsen can be equally be blamed for, because they dislike each other. But it gives Napoleon a wake-up call.
It does.
And the very next day, of course, he orders the Grand Army to abandon Moscow and retreat.
Okay. So now we're in the retreat, and we jump ahead to the Battle of, and I'll let you pronounce it since I have trouble with this particular
Malaga Slavitz.
Thank you, sir.
What Malaya Yaroslavets did is it prevented Napoleon from reaching the unaffected, still rich southern provinces of Russian Empire, where the French army could have resupplied and wintered. And instead, it pushed Napoleon back to that war-ravaged path that the army took on the way in.
Agreed.
And I think that That made Napoleon realize that he will not be able to winter inside Russia, that he would have to get out. So that's why in kind of in my thinking, Malo Yaroslavets is this turning point of the war where Napoleon wants to get out as quickly as possible from Russia so he can do kind of the rebuilding somewhere in the Duchy of Warsaw rather than necessarily inside Russia. If Malo Yaroslavets had ended differently and if Napoleon had defeated Kutuzov there, then I think there was a greater probability of Napoleon wintering somewhere in the Vilna, between the Vilna and Smolensk area.
Right.
That area was, of course, recently acquired by Russia as a result of Polish partitions. There was a much greater goodwill towards the French from the Polish-Lithuanian population, and Napoleon could have stayed there for that winter.
Now, during this retreat, and this is, again, a debate amongst historians, it was said that Kutuzov escorted Napoleon out of Russia without legitimately attacking him. I find this to be complete bullocks and nonsense. He attacked him at Vyazma and Krasny, and, you know, when they crossed the river to finally get out of Russia. It was said that Kutuzov told British observer Robert Wilson, quote, "I am by no means sure that the total destruction of the Emperor Napoleon and his army would be such a benefit to Russia. His succession would fall to the United Kingdom, whose domination would then be intolerable," end quote. What do you think of that opinion that Kutuzov was not trying to destroy Napoleon?
I think there is certain truth to it.
Okay.
So Kutuzov, if we look at the letters, if we look at the conversation he's had with Wilson, with Bennigsen, with others, he always pointed out that the complete collapse of the Napoleonic Empire would not be in the interest of Russia. So first question would be, what would happen to France? What would happen to Europe if the empire disappeared, right?
Mm-hmm.
Will this unleash another revolutionary or political cycle or cycle of political turmoil?
Mm-hmm.
How will the political division of Europe work out? Where will Russia's role be in all of this? And for Kutuzov, I think the biggest concern was this. If he actively tried to destroy Napoleon, and what I mean is kind of completely destroy, annihilate the Grand Armée, try to kill or capture Napoleon, it will result in tens of thousands of unnecessary Russian losses.
Mm-hmm.
And Kutuzov repeatedly pointed out that it is the, you know, the big battalions, right, to use that famous expression, the big battalions that really matter at the end of the day.
Yeah.
That Napoleon, by November, for Kutuzov, this war is over.
Yeah.
He can't see, after Malo Yaroslavets, he can't see how Napoleon can stay and turn this war around. So Kutuzov was already kind of fights the second war against him down the road in 1813. What will be that like? And for him, Russia needs to retain strike force. He needs to retain army to be in contention. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, as he tells Wilson, as he tells Bennigsen, it will be Britain who will benefit ultimately from Napoleon's collapse. And he didn't, Kutuzov doesn't want to do it.
Yeah.
Now, I do agree with you that it doesn't mean that he completely avoided attacking, right?
I think it's an unfair criticism. At Vyazma, he almost destroyed Davao, and at Krasny, he almost destroyed Ney. He was very, very close.
Although at Krasny, for example, Kutuzov at one point interrogates, I think, a prisoner, and he asks him if Napoleon is in Krasny. And the he's told, yes, that's, you know, he's still there. And so Kutuzov says, okay, let's hold off on the attack. Mm-hmm. And the reason, again, is because he believed that if Napoleon was present, the French, the Grand Armée will fight to the end.
Right.
What's the point, right? What's the point of that?
Right.
Let him escape with the remnants of the army.
Right.
Let the weather, the cold, the hunger do its damage to Napoleon.
Yeah.
But let him survive because he will be the lesser of the evils that might come.
So Jumping ahead again to the story, Napoleon obviously leaves the army, I think, in early December, and then the remnant of the army gets out later in December and of 1812. And then 1813, what happens to Kutuzov? He's been under a lot of stress.
I think what happens is that he arrives in December in Vilna, nowadays Vilnius, and Emperor Alexander joins him there. He and his kind of posse and all the sycophants and all that arrive in Vilna. And Alexander right away sidelines Kutuzov. He effectively, like in 1805, by the statute of the Russian army, when the Tsar is present, he holds the supreme command. So Kutuzov is sidelined.
Yep.
But Alexander also removed Kutuzov's appointees and replaced them with his own men. Chief of staff is replaced, and Kanao is kind of directly responsible or answerable to Alexander. The duty generals are replaced and so on. And so Kutuzov now finds himself essentially in the same situation as he was in November of 1805. Still nominally in charge, but in reality, not really. And he tries to argue and kind of explain to Alexander that Russian army needs time to rest, kind of regroup. It is often forgotten that Russian army is not immune to the practice of the war, right?
Right.
At Tarutino, Kutuzov was able to mobilize 120,000 men, and by the time they reached the border, there are less than 40,000 of them. So there's a lot of sick, wounded, stragglers somewhere in between 600 mile distance.
What did Marshal Soult say after Eylau? Our bullets are not made of cotton.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, no.
And of course, the same winter affects the Russian troops as it does the French. Of course, the French would have, worse condition in terms of the lack of some, supplies and clothing. But if you read the Russian memoirs, you will see how woeful the conditions were in the Russian army as well.
Yeah.
And so Kutuzov argued that the army needed a respite.
Yeah.
And he convinced Tsar to give them about 2.5 weeks of rest.
Yeah.
So there is a kind of misconception that Kutuzov didn't want to attack beyond the Russian borders. No, what he wanted is that rest. And once the army was rested, he was perfectly fine with conducting a campaign across the border.
Right.
But that campaign will be not of his planning.
Right.
Tsar is, as I said, present. It's Tsar who takes the charge. It's Tsar who decides what, where, and how. And Kutuzov actually plays the second fiddle, but you already mentioned that after this brutal campaign, Kutuzov is sick.
He's 67 years old at this point.
And I mean, he's been in the field since 1810. Really, he's been commanding these troops, and it's a rough life.
Yep.
The winter of 1812 is really cold, so he suffers from various illnesses. So by 1813, he really needs a break, but he can't leave the army. He stays, and at one of the cities in Germany, he is greeted by the population, by people of cities that came out with flowers and all, and that's in late March, early April, and Kutuzov got off his carriage to greet them. And once he did, he was not wearing warm clothes, and he got cold. And that cold kind of developed into some more serious illness. We're not sure exactly what it was, but he kind of complained of shivers and fever, and his condition progressively got worse. And in late April, he passed away.
What do you think his legacy was in the end of the day?
His legacy. His legacy, I think, is multifold. The strategy that he pursued in 1812, I think, was correct.
Yep.
It is true that it is a strategy that Barclay de Tolly laid the foundation for, but I would say that if Kutuzov was in charge of the army in June of 1812, he would have done exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
So I think He has a nickname, right? His full Russian name, because as your listeners know, Russians use patronymic names.
Mm-hmm.
So his name was Mikhail Ilarionovich. So his father's name is Ilarion, but his nickname was Fabian Ilarionovich. And that's a reference to the Fabian, right? The Cunctator, the great Roman general who defeated Hannibal
right
in the Punic War,
right?
And that's the nickname that predates 1812. That's a nickname that goes back all the way to the Russo-Turkish Wars, because people appreciate his methodic approach to war, kind of rational reasoning. So I don't expect him rushing the battle in June or July of 1812 like Bagration would have if he was the commander-in-chief. So I think the strategy that he put in place after becoming supreme commander was the right one and perfect one. He Kutuzov may not be the flashiest, may not be the most exciting commander of this period, but he was the right commander for the right place at the right time.
Which is oftentimes
is more important than being the most capable and most talented.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I think he reminds me of like a chess player who's in no rush to make his next move. He knew what he was doing. He was just not going to move at anyone's behest other than the Tsar. Wilson says Kutuzov was utterly lazy, incompetent, and perhaps even a friend of the French.
And of course, that's said in 1812 when Wilson unsuccessfully tried to convince Kutuzov to attack and destroy Napoleon's army. And so there's a lot of ill will from Wilson on that.
Yeah, I just think he knew what he was doing. He was a sly old fox, and he wasn't going to rush anything that he didn't want to do.
Yeah, and in August, when he's appointed as a commander-in-chief, Kutuzov has a last meal, kind of last dinner with his family. He's not going to see them again. He will die, without seeing his wife or his children or relatives. Mm. But at that dinner, of course, everyone kind of was fretting and asking him, what are you going to do? And he tells his family that, "I don't hope to defeat Napoleon," and which is a remarkable statement to make if you are a new supreme commander of an army, right, tasked with defeating Napoleon. But he says, "I don't expect to defeat Napoleon. I expect to outsmart him."
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, this is what I see him accomplishing, is that through this ethical approach to war, he effectively outsmarts Napoleon.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. I think we should end on that. I think in the long run, I think he did. I think he had a plan. He stuck to it no matter what the sycophants or yes men of the Tsar wanted him to do. And at the end, it worked out. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of suffering and carnage involved, but he did what he wanted to do.
Well, let me add one point maybe, because I think this is one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book, and that is about the misuse of history.
Mm-hmm.
Because Kutuzov offers a very good example of myth-making, because we oftentimes talk about Napoleonic myth, Napoleonic legend, but there is a strong Kutuzovian myth and legend that has been going on in Russia for, we can say, better part of two centuries.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a myth that state very carefully cultivated. And Kutuzov, who was derided, who was criticized, who was not particularly well-liked by his contemporaries. You see a lot of criticism leveled at him while he was alive.
Yeah.
But after his death, something unique happens. Alexander, even though he disliked the general, he realized the opportunity he has to kind of create the a narrative,
mm-hmm.
great victory. And so he made arrangements to have Kutuzov buried in the great cathedral of the Holy Mother of Kazan in St. Petersburg.
Mm.
And that cathedral then was turned into a cathedral of military glory of Russian Empire.
Right.
All the trophies that the Russian army captured during the war will be deposited there. And Kutuzov's grave will be kind of the shrine, right, of the man who brought Russia to the pinnacle of its glory. And that turned Kutuzov into an institution that was very difficult to criticize. So you see in the 19th century, people tried not to challenge the existing narratives or the state narratives of Kutuzov as a glorious figure because mm-hmm. it was unpopular. And then this narrative becomes even more entrenched in Soviet time, because during World War II, when the Nazi Germany attacked Soviet Union, and the Soviets suffered a calamitous, right, beginning of the war, hundreds mm-hmm. of thousands of losses in the first yep. 2 years. Well, Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin used Kutuzov as an excuse, kind of as a cover-up, by arguing that the Nazi attack on Soviet Union was not a surprise. The Soviet defeats were not really defeats, but were all part of a careful, deliberate strategy that right. Stalin put in place, just like Kutuzov did in 1812. And that really turned Kutuzov into this mythical figure.
National hero.
That it's really a legend, right? There's got a national hero that is completely unassailable. And yeah. that remained the foundation for much of the Russian historiography until the collapse of Soviet Union. Now, the new generation of Russian historians effectively have to struggle against this myth, against this legend, and they try to show the reality, which is very hard to do because people already have kind of bought into this existing narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's called controlling the narrative. And that's what Napoleon was trying to do on St. Helena. He was trying to write his narrative.
That's precisely. Exactly.
Yeah. And I think that's a great point to end on, you know, is even like you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, you know, just because there's a book written on Kutuzov 20, 30 years ago, doesn't mean it's entirely accurate.
That's right. Absolutely.
You know, so do your research, kids. Do your research.